Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 409. This week, the questions are taken from guides 479 and 480 on HMS Asia and Le Terrible, both ships of the line of the 1700s, along with the Wednesday videos on the rise and fall of the escort carrier and the bombardment of Algiers 1816, and the Friday videos on Rule the Waves 3 and Who Sank the Fastest. Antonius Pius asks, in your video on HMS Asia, there's a battle shown at about 40 seconds in. How realistic is it? Many paintings and drawings show similar chaos. Were there that many large chaotic engagements in the time period, or is it in many cases artistic license? And if there were such engagements, were there friendly fire incidents due to cannon shot aimed at the rigging going right through and hitting a friendly ship, or did the crews know to stop aiming high to prevent that? So this is the painting in question. And the answer is, they can be realistic, but you have to judge sometimes on the individual battle being depicted, and also sometimes if it's not supposed to be depicting a particular battle, sometimes it's just generic, you also have to look at the engagements in question, because you do also sometimes get instances where the engagement shown is of a given battle, but it is not precisely showing what happened in a particular moment in that battle. It might amalgamate several different things that happen in that battle over the space of many hours and put them all in one place to give a general feeling, kind of telling a story rather than directly depicting a specific moment. Now, this particular one, as you might be able to tell from the flags, is depicting one of the many battles of the Anglo-Dutch Wars. And in those circumstances, this kind of battle in this all over the place melee is a more realistic than you'd think. There is a certain degree of artistic license here. Obviously, you've got two ships sinking in the foreground, extremely close to each other. Some ships were sunk in these battles, but to have two ships sinking at almost exactly the same time, a couple hundred yards apart, that didn't happen, but they've kind of, again, agglomerated things in for more dramatic effect. But we do know from things like the St. James's Day battle, the Four Days battle, etc., that while they were trying to fight in a line, and they kind of started that way, very often it would devolve into these kind of patchwork melees, especially when you were looking at either conditions where the wind shifted and threw everybody into confusion for a bit, or you had some of the bigger, incredibly powerful, but also somewhat unwieldy, particularly English ships of the line, which, again, especially in confused wind conditions, did end up kind of drifting off on their own, but simultaneously usually just being so much of a powerful threat compared to the relatively lightweight Dutch ships that they could kind of get away with it. There's at least one battle, which I think I mentioned before, where Sovereign of the Seas just ends up drifting through the Dutch lines and is assaulted multiple times, boarded multiple times, and essentially just sitting there going, yeah, cool, okay, I guess I'm a floating castle, quite literally. And eventually does have to get a little bit of assistance from some of the other English ships, but that's mostly because her crew are getting exhausted, fighting constant boarding and counterboarding attacks against the numerous Dutch ships that are coming up against her, not because she's actually in any significant danger of sinking. As time goes on, when you get into what feel like the more classic age of sail, more and more battles are, at least until the roughly speaking Nelsonian period, fought in line formation, and therefore this kind of action would be less common, with notable exceptions, things like Quiberon Bay, etc. And as far as friendly fire incidents, there was the occasional friendly fire incident from people misidentifying vessels in the gun smoke and so forth, but that's one of the reasons these massive battle ensigns were hoisted, to avoid that. And in terms of shot overshooting and then hitting another vessel, it could in theory happen, and I'm sure over the course of all these various battles it probably did, at least at points. However, it would be fairly rare, because if you were at a point where you were elevating your guns high to try and shoot out the enemy's rigging, you're probably at a reasonable distance, and if you're at a reasonable distance, that probably meant you weren't in such a close swirling melee that there might be another friendly ship directly behind your target, you know, within your gunshot range. And if there was, well, you could hold off for 10 seconds till the bearing was slightly different. And if you were much, much closer, and the whole thing was a very much a swirling melee, and there was a chance that your shots might go long and then hit someone who was some distance beyond, well, at that point, it's relatively unlikely that you'd be able to elevate your guns high enough to actually, you know, take out their rigging. You'd probably just be firing onto their decks to kill their boarding or counterboarding parties, or firing into their hull to try and disarm and or sink them. And the job of going after the masts would be almost exclusively picked gun crews in the forecastle and stern castle. Zajutz asks, could you do a video on early shipbreaking, as in the practicalities of what happens when you read about a ship that was broken up? Was it sold to a yard for breaking? Were there certain stipulations? What happened to the copper, etc.? How were the different timbers and planks used? Were they sold to carpenters, used to make furniture, etc., etc.? I certainly could add it to the list of things to cover. That's not a problem. It's something I do want to talk about at some point. However, there will be one slight limitation in that while there are a certain number of photos of, should we say, modern, at least modern for the channel, ships being broken up, like here you can see three Omaha class being broken up in a dry dock simultaneously. For obvious reasons, there aren't really that many photos of Age of Sail ships being broken up, and precious few paintings at that. There are a handful of photos of Age of Sail ships being broken up in the 20th century, the ones that survived that long, but even those are fairly thin on the ground. So I'll have to see what I can do about that. But very briefly, Age of Sail breaking up could take a number of formats, because unless the ship was absolutely rotten to the core, there would be major salvageable elements directly related to ship construction. And obviously there is stuff that you can pull off of steel ships as well, but I'm talking major structural beams that you could reuse, which isn't really a thing so much with more modern vessels. And so sometimes you would have a vessel just go into a Navy yard and the Navy would break it up, and whatever that they found in there that was of use just went straight back into the naval stores to be used in the construction of new ships and the repair of existing vessels. Conversely, it might be sold to private interests and they might keep those parts to themselves so that they could use them to build various ships, both civilian and military. They might sell on some of the good timber to other yards. So, for example, a yard might have the facilities to break up a ship of the line, but they might not necessarily have the facilities to build a ship of the line. But if they rescue, let's say, four dozen good quality knees that can support 32-pounder gun deck, and the biggest ship they can actually build is a frigate that's only at best going to take 24-pounders, they might then sell them on to another shipyard, which can make use of them. Obviously, rotten timber would just be disposed of. And then you have this kind of intermediate bit where you might have offcuts. So you might have a large timber, but let's say 70% of it is rotten, 30% of it is still good. But for most shipbuilding purposes, no one needs 30% of a long plank. They want the plank, or at least a good chunk of it. And the same thing for various other bits and pieces. And there, for example, in English law and dockyards, there were provisions whereby these sections, which would be no real use for major ship construction, could then essentially be taken by the dockyard workers, the foremen, etc., and utilized for their own purposes. Kind of, you know, a bit like how if a builder is stripping a house out, you're paying them to take away all the muck and debris. But if that includes ripping out, say, an old water tank, which is pure copper or near enough, well, you are trying to get rid of a waste asset. But to them, they could, instead of just taking it to the local dump, they might take that specifically to a metal recycling plant and sell it on for more money. And that's kind of generally permitted, unless you're really tight. And it was the same thing with the dockyards. However, one of the reasons we know so much about this specific detail is that there's endless amounts of revisions and case law and prosecutions and stuff about people taking it too far and going, oh, well, you know, yeah, there's this rib or frame that could be reused on another warship. But, well, there's a bit of rot in the top 2 feet. Now, strictly speaking, we could still use that. If it's a first rate, we could use it on a second rate, or we could just put a little cap on it. You know, it would just take a bit of work, but we're going to mark it off officially as rotten and surplus to requirements. Therefore, someone can just walk off with it. And hey, look, now they've got the, I don't know, the central beam for the roof of a new house or something for free. So furniture built out of random scrap parts was actually relatively common. And even in the Second World War and afterwards, things like the teak decking on ships that were being broken up did tend to get sold off. And actually, there's catalogues in the 50s and 60s in the UK where they actually advertise this furniture was built using the teak decking from this ship that's been scrapped in the past couple of years. But when you get up to the scale of houses, generally speaking, unless you've got corrupt practices going on, the timber that would be large enough to be useful in the construction of a house is also large enough to be useful in the construction of a ship, and therefore should be retained by the dockyard. So a lot of the times when you see buildings like, oh yes, well, you know, our timbers were built using this or that other ship when it was broken up. Maybe, but probably actually not. Probably what you're looking at is either potentially corruption going on in the yard to get some timbers out. That's entirely possible. Possibly also that there may actually have been an issue with the wood that made it unsuitable for ship use, but it might just about be still useful for house use because it's got to take less stress and strain over time. Or it might be a reward granted to a particularly conscientious worker, or possibly, although this is rare, it may actually have been bought out by someone. So the ship's being broken up. Perhaps there's not so much of a demand for ship quality construction material. And someone shows up and says, hey, I'll give you, you know, 120 quid for all of that. And someone goes, yeah, okay, fine. You know, it's a legitimate transaction, which is why, for example, the Chesapeake Mill over in the UK, which is now an antique shop, actually contains a good chunk of the frigate USS Chesapeake, because for whatever reason, people didn't necessarily want the timbers and it was just bought up and used in the construction of a mill. Chris Reiter asks, the SMS Kaiser showed during the Battle of Lissa that the wooden ship of the line was still theoretically a viable combatant as late as 1858. In your opinion, which year or technological development finally made the wooden ship of the line fully obsolete, even as a second line vessel? I think it is going to vary somewhat because of the nature of the Industrial Revolution and the spread of ironclads. You did have a certain time where a ship might be obsolete in the English Channel, where obviously England and France were building the latest and greatest in ironclads, but that vessel might still be completely competitive out in, say, Australia, where ironclads just weren't. Or when you're talking about second or third or fourth line powers, which only have to worry about their local antagonists. You know, if Britain and France have got two dozen ironclads apiece, but let's say you're in South America and your only competitors in the area have wooden frigates, well, a wooden ship of the line is still a perfectly viable combatant, even if it's a completely hopelessly obsolete combatant in the North Sea, and it has been for 10 years at that point, let's say. But if I had to say, look, when this thing becomes available, that is, at least locally, that is when the wooden ship of the line becomes obsolete. I think I would have to go with when heavy guns capable of shooting both shot and shell become readily available to the local power and relatively widespread. And when I'm talking about heavy guns, I'm not talking about heavy guns as in, like, you know, 6,800 10-pounders like you find on Warrior. I'm talking about guns so heavy that you are having to resort to turrets, barbettes, or central batteries to support a relatively small number of them, as opposed to broadside ironclads, which will obviously have lots and lots of guns, maybe not as much as a ship of the line, but still. And the reason that I say that is, well, it's several fold, actually. Firstly, those guns are so big, you're having to concentrate them in such an area, it's extremely unlikely that a wooden ship of the line can actually support those guns, so it can't have the similar firepower. At the same time, yes, those guns are going to be able to fire very devastating shots or shells, and they are probably going to do huge amounts of damage to a wooden ship of the line, even from a single impact. But that's less of the issue, and more of the issue is that those guns will have ridiculous armor penetration relative to the guns of, say, the early 1860s. And as a result, the ship that carries those guns should at least in theory be armored against its own guns, and other ships will start armoring up to try and deal with those guns, at which point the ironclads in question, which is a, this is why I said it has to be fairly wide proliferation there of these weapons, but at that point the ironclads are going to be functionally immune to any kind of gun you can realistically put on a wooden ship of the line and can devastate you with their own broadsides. And that's when the ship of the line, I think, becomes completely obsolete from the perspective of whatever navy it is in question. Because even during the time of Lissa, while of course Kaiser is famous for ramming things, she could still carry guns that were a threat to at least some of the ironclads present, and of course a good number of the unarmored or very lightly armored ships present. Pyro Bandit asks, I noted during some research that the heaviest French warships of the 18th century potentially could carry up to 48-pounder guns, similar to the English occasionally experimenting with 42-pounders. Is this accurate, and were they 48-pounders in English, or were they 48 French livres? There were some French ships that carried 48 livres, so there's part of the answer, or 52 English pound cannon. But you could only really say it took place in the 18th century just. So the idea was bandied about and implemented at the very end of the 1600s, so the very end of the 17th century, and therefore it was around for the very, very early part of the 1700s, i.e. the very start of the 18th century, not the Napoleonic era, which is of the other end of the 18th century. But they were not very common. They were only found on the absolute biggest of the French first-rate ships of the line, like the Louis XIV, as you can see here. But the French very quickly abandoned them in favour of the 36 livres, simply because, like the 42-pounders in English service, the French found that the 48 livres was just so immensely heavy, it required a really large gun crew. It was big enough that it actually physically restricted the number you could carry on a ship, because obviously they needed to be spaced wider apart, and their sheer weight also limited the number you could fit on the lower gun deck. You could fit considerably more 36 livre guns down there. And as you might expect, you know, incredibly difficult to handle because of the weight of the guns. And yeah, try loading a 52-pounder cannonballs all the time. It slowed the rate of fire something ridiculous to the point that, yeah, your one broadside, which would probably take you half an hour to set up, would be incredibly lethal. But then even with everybody breaking their backs, it would be 5-10 minutes or more before you could have another broadside of those guns ready. Whereas a broadside of 36 livre guns, sure, you might not technically have quite the same power as your 48 livre guns, but you could probably get two or three of those broadsides off in the time it took you to get but one of your larger broadsides off, and you'd have more chances of hitting because you'd have more guns available. So even the ships that had them tended to lose them pretty darn quickly in exchange for 36 livre weapons. P.K. Zhong asks, by how much were the North Carolinas slowed down due to vibration issues in actual service? I've generally heard that they lost around a knot or two of speed from their design spec, even once their vibration issues had been fixed. So, ideally, the North Carolinas were supposed to have a design speed of 28 knots. Both ships slightly exceeded that design speed on trials by fractions of a knot, but the US Navy generally rated them at 27 to 27 and a half knots once they were in service. Part of that was because of the various changes that had to be done to try and address the vibration issues. But part of it was also the fact that, in part because of those vibration issues extending their trials period, between their initially entering into first sea trials and then being fully ready to commit to the Pacific, or initially the Atlantic, depending on the ship, the battleships had gained a fair amount of weight in the form of various extra bits of equipment, including obviously radar and anti-aircraft guns. And that meant that they were just displacing more, and therefore their top speed would generally be somewhat less. And, you know, they're also carrying a bit more fuel and things like that for operational range and to help refuel other vessels. I do at some point actually need to do a video that goes into a lot more detail about the vibrational issues on North Carolina and Washington, in part because it's just very interesting, and in part because I've also managed to dig up some period reports from the US Navy where they go into exceptional detail about both what they suspect the causes are, obviously initially, and then in the post-war write-up what they are pretty sure the causes were, and what the fixes were, both to the North Carolina class and to subsequent classes, obviously the South Dakotas and the Iowas. And one of the fixes that was a lot easier to implement in later classes, although they did include it in the North Carolinas eventually, was actually changes to the skeg design, not just the placement of them, but also their style. So these, as the label says, are the hull test models for the North Carolina class. And you can see that if you look at pictures of these versus pictures of the skegs of either a South Dakota class or an Iowa, these skegs are a lot more substantial, a lot more square, and a lot closer to the propellers. And one of the bigger issues that was identified by the trials that the US did, it wasn't just natural resonant vibration, although that was a big problem, but one of the causes of that was that these skegs were actually causing dead water or vortex zones, depending on the exact trial speed, et cetera, right behind them, which then meant that, well, in the way they were designed, right behind them was the propeller blades. So you'd have a propeller blade that would sweep through, let's say, 160, 170 degrees of an arc in water that was just racing along past the ship with relatively smooth flow. And then suddenly, again, depending on what speed it was going, it would then hit this patch of water that could be quite turbulent and would have a different pressure and speed to the rest of the water. And that would throw the propeller completely, especially because it wasn't even a balanced thing, top and bottom. The problem was a lot worse closer to the hull than it was further down, further away from the hull. And so with that, you could swap the propellers, you know, 3, 4, 5 blades, however much you like. You'd only have a very limited effect on the problem until you also started reshaping the skegs. So, say, compare that to an Iowa class, especially because I've got so many glorious 4K images from USS New Jersey going into dry dock, and you'll see those skegs are not only far less square, but they're shaped to have a lot more space between them and the propellers themselves. Roeno asks, during the age of steel and iron ships, how did ships deal with thermal isolation? Steel and iron is quite thermally conductive. On the decks, the wood gave some insulation, but how did they deal with the sides? There were a number of ways. Some ships, especially once the technology became available, would use air conditioning, particularly if in the US. Others would just use general ventilation, but there were also color schemes. So, for example, especially in the 20th century, one of the ways you can sometimes tell if a ship is on a tropical station is if it's especially bright or white in the picture, like this picture of HMS Cornwall, because, well, if you paint the side of the ship white or a similar colour, it reflects an awful lot more heat, and therefore that prevents a lot of heat getting into the hull. But sometimes, though, even those measures wouldn't be enough. And there were certainly instances where ships' crews would just go up and sleep on deck because the interior, at least of the upper portion of the hull, was just intolerably hot. Another benefit that the ships did have, of course, though, was that the lower portion of their hull was in the sea, which is a great heat sink. So as long as you could survive the, you know, 1, 2, or 3 decks that were above water, if you could get to the below waterline decks, they generally would stay pretty cool unless they happened to be the boiler room at almost any condition, simply because the sea would take all the heat away. In some ships, insulation would be tried as well, although given the period, a lot of the insulation that might be put in would be asbestos, which, you know, just trading one bad thing for another. But that's also one of the many reasons why they'd have lots of portholes wherever they could, because, you know, the portholes aren't just to let light in. It's also a case of when it gets ridiculously hot, open the porthole and you get some fresh air. Alzi Monster asks, what Admiralty weirdness resulted in such oddly specific prices for completed warships or prizes in the Age of Sail? Was there a formula used, or was this just some committee being really weird? Well, when a ship was being newly constructed, every single thing that went into that ship would have an itemized cost. Everything from the pulley blocks to the lengths of rope to the bowsprit, the masts, etc. So while you might have some things that were priced in bulk, like say the timbers that were used for planking, other things like the guns would each have a specific price. And even, as I said, anything down to even the pulley blocks. If a pulley block was arbitrarily, let's say, 4 shillings and 6 pence, well, every single pulley block was 4 shillings and 6 pence. So you had to multiply that all up. And if the compass binnacle was £3, 6 shillings and 2 pence, then that got entered on the ledger as well. Bearing in mind, obviously, that at that stage in time, a penny was worth a heck of a lot more than it is today. So actually, whether it be 1 pence, 2 pence, or 3 pence, did make a bit fair difference in the price of not just the item, but also collectively in the price of the ship. But then when you add it all up, obviously, that's going to give you not a round number. It's going to give you a certain number of pounds, certain number of shillings, and a certain number of pence. And similarly with prizes, the hull as a whole might be valued at a somewhat rounder number just to make things a little bit easier. But various individual elements within the prize would also be valued, like the value of, again, things like the ship's compass, its navigating instruments, if it had any left, its guns, its fixtures and fittings, whatever spare supplies in there might be that could be taken off and used on other ships. And again, with all of those things itemized, you'd end up with very weirdly specific prices, or at least weirdly specifically sounding to us today. The real Ezra Scholl asks, when the Washington Naval Treaty was being created, what was the understanding of its intended duration? Was it hoped that it would be a permanent fixture, maybe occasionally updating tonnage and ship caps as technology progressed? Or was it understood to be a short-term way to lower tensions among major powers, or something else entirely? To a certain degree, it depended on which government you asked. But purely by the terms of the treaty was actually supposed to last until the end of 1936, which is why you will sometimes find period references in the 30s that will still reference the Washington Treaty, even though technically these days we think of things more in terms of London and London 2 for the 1930s. But you've got to remember that London and London 2 were essentially modifications to the pre-existing Washington Treaty framework. So that's basically why people were still referring to Washington, because that was the originator of it all. So it was therefore obviously officially intended to last 15 years. But the general idea, at least amongst the major signatories, was that this would provide an upper limit framework. And obviously it was, you know, it didn't say you had to build up to those limits. It was just, this was the maximum you could do. And in the interim, various conferences were held to try and further reduce armaments, not just naval armaments, but armaments generally. And a lot of them actually failed. A lot of them, you know, you don't hear all that much about, say, the Geneva Conference of 1927, because it didn't really go anywhere. It's only the two that actually got any substantial momentum behind them, London in 1930 and London 2, which you tend to hear all that much about unless you're really deep diving into interwar disarmament proposals. And there were clauses built into the Washington Treaty that would allow it to be updated should new technological or other issues come up, and or people choose to withdraw early. But the general gist of it was that it was to be a stepping stone towards a more regulated and balanced worldwide military situation, with some people hoping perhaps it would be the first step on the road to disarmament. Although I think even at the time, a lot of people recognised that even if that was a nice ideal, it was also very naive. BK Zhang asks, did any other nation have an anti-slavery squadron or squadrons? To a certain degree, yes. As I've covered in my anti-slavery series so far, the US Navy did occasionally send one or two ships down in the early period of anti-slavery operations. As time progressed through the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, you did see somewhat more and somewhat more regular deployments of the US Navy on anti-slavery patrols. But the whole thing was still somewhat limited by the fact, obviously, you had a good chunk of the United States, which was still in favor of slavery quite openly, and it was legal there. So, obviously, with their political influence, it somewhat constrained the US Navy compared to what perhaps the Navy itself might have liked to do, or the Northern states, for example, might have liked to do. And then, obviously, post the American Civil War, there was a much stronger drive for it, but also the Atlantic slave trade at that point was pretty much dead. You also had occasional forays by the French, and in the early 1830s, when the French signed a reciprocal treaty with the UK, which allowed the UK to go after French slavers, one of the parts of the treaty said that both sides had to maintain anti-slavery squadrons, and that neither a nation squadron should be more than twice the strength of the other. Now, the Royal Navy was far more enthusiastic about it, so the West Africa Squadron always was the larger of the two, but it did mean that the French had actually designated a force of usually 3 to 4 ships, which would act as an anti-slavery unit as well as their other duties. And at some points, you would occasionally see other nations pitch in, either on general principle, but especially in the early part of the anti-slavery effort, more often it would be because Britain was pressuring them diplomatically to end the slave trade and give the Royal Navy the right to seize and search their ships. And in some cases, this was diplomatically resisted for a time, but the sort of, if you're not necessarily the fig leaf, but the concession that they made to stop the British pressing them for a right of search and seizure was to say that they would deploy their own anti-slavery ships in order to deal with their own slavers in their own way. Obviously, a lot of those were relatively lackadaisical, again, especially early on, and they tended to either drift away as the slave trade died down, or drift away because Britain managed to pressure those countries into rights of search and seizure. And once or twice, they would actually, build up to at least a ship permanently on station for a bit. Vicky asks, what if Pellew had brought 25 ships of the line to the bombardment of Algiers anyway, plus proportionate numbers of smaller ships, on the grounds that there is no such thing as overkill? There's only open fire, followed by I need to reload. Well, given the damage that his flagship did to its chosen section of the Algiers defences, one can only speculate at the utter devastation that an entire battle line of 25 two and three deckers would have done. Probably ground a good portion of Algiers' military section into a fine powder and then blown the powder away for good measure. Although I will say, just generally with that video on the bombardment of Algiers, it went pretty well as a video when it was initially released. And then in more recent times, I would say in the past couple of months, I have had the weirdest bunch of commentators picking up on it in the comments. You get views, then it goes a little quiet over time. But then there's this random uptick of commentators, and I'm looking at them, I'm like, I did not know Barbary pirate apologists existed, but apparently this is a thing. Which is somewhat bizarre to me, but okay, fair enough. Some people have got to have some very weird and historically completely ungrounded fetishes, I guess. And the thing is, if they'd been trying to say, oh, well, actually, there's this other side to the bombardment that we would like to represent, I'd be like, okay, fine. That could be quite interesting. What's the Algerian national view of it? This kind of thing. But some of the stuff that they, I mean, and I'm not all of them, but a good chunk of them have come up with some really off-the-wall stuff. There's at least one commentator who's insisting that every single nation that went through the Mediterranean was paying great tribute to Algiers right before this bombardment happened. I was like, well, no, various nations did pay tribute over time, which I did actually cover in the video, but not everybody, and not all at the same time. Someone else that told me to get my history right. Morocco was never part of the Ottoman Empire, at which point I went back through the script and went, where did that come from? Because Algiers is not part of Morocco. I never mentioned Morocco in the script. And the only reference I made to the more general Barbary Corsair states outside of Pellew's visits to Tripoli and so forth was the fact that the Barbary Corsair states were the leftovers of a mixture of Ottoman and general Islamic expansion, which both pre and post dated the Ottomans. And Morocco is kind of a leftover of general Islamic expansion that predates the Ottomans. So why Morocco not being part of the Ottoman Empire has any relevance to what the video is about, I don't know. And a fair number of them also wanted to yell a lot about the potentially understandable bad blood between Algerians and the French, because obviously, as I mentioned at the very end of the video, the French would occupy Algiers and Algeria generally a couple of decades down the line. But again, what's that got to do with the bombardment of Algiers in 1816, which had a very proximate cause and a very proximate finish? There'd be like someone popping into my video on the Second Pacific Fleet and complaining that I wasn't talking about Soviet gulags and purges in the 1940s for all the relevance it actually has. Oh, and one particular loon that actually just made me laugh at the vast historical ignorance or potentially propaganda idiocy that had been drilled into them, who absolutely insisted that there was no such thing as the Barbary States and that every single city, etc., on the entire North African coast was united under one grand Algerian sultanate and everybody was united against, well, everyone who wasn't from there. At which point I was going, okay, well, one, go fight the guy who randomly mentioned Morocco. And two, why would Pellew negotiate separately with Tunis and Tripoli if they were all just subsidiaries of the greater North African Algerian Empire? RTRX2SJ asks, are we ever going to get a Drakenefeld-designed naval grand strategy game? Bizarrely enough, yes, actually, you will. I don't know exactly how long it'll take, maybe a couple of years. I'm starting a little bit easier with a card-based game, which will have relatively simple rules and also somewhat more complex rules. So the simple rules will allow you to play it basically like any deck builder card game and play through pretty quickly. And the more complex rules will allow you to actually more closely simulate naval combat within the scope of a card game. So it'll be a bit more complicated and a bit longer lasting in terms of how long each game lasts than perhaps your average Magic the Gathering game or something like that. Almost verging on rules that you could actually maybe even swap the cards out for ship models and run a simple-ish naval combat game based on them. But anyway, that's one game that I've got in the works and hopefully will be coming out later this year. I'm also working on a completely separate non-naval related game, which will be a sort of another step forward, which will be more on, in terms of complexity, more in the realms of something like Settlers of Catan or that kind of board game. And then, yes, eventually there will be a naval grand strategy game. I actually have already vaguely drafted out the concept for it, for both, because one is Age of Steam and Steel based, the other is Age of Sail based. I'm probably going to pursue the Age of Sail based one first, because that kind of game is less common in that sphere rather than the sort of World War I, World War II period where there's lots of different competing games. But at the moment, I'm still trying to figure out the format that I want the game to run in. I know how I want you to take your ships and upgrade them and compete against other people. That bit, I've already got pretty sussed out. But the overarching game framework in terms of, is it kind of a free play? Everybody starts off at the same point and then you develop naturally from there until somebody achieves a victory condition, which does have its attractions in terms of giving the player more freedom. But the flip side is, of course, someone might start running away with the game and, a third of the way through, it might become very, very clear who's going to win. But outside of just, turning your cards over and saying, OK, I give up, you've got to play through a lot more time when you know that the other guy's has won the game. Or do you go with a kind of a more overarching turn structure where you everyone starts at a certain point and then there's a fixed number of turns and then you total up or victory points or compare results at that point and then you move on to another stage where everyone again starts out roughly equally and so on and so forth, which means that obviously someone might win the first round but someone else might then pull back and win the second round. So the winner of the first round might go into the second round with some advantages, but not enough that a good player can't steal back the momentum and win the second round. And then someone else might win the third round. And obviously that limits player scope for, you know, free play and growth generally, but it does mean that the game remains competitive and open for the, at least between players of vaguely equal skill all the way through, which might be a bit more interesting for people. So I'm still trying to work that out and a few other bits and pieces. So see how that goes. Will Sanders asks, since I doubt there'll ever be enough support for the Royal Navy in Jane Austen's work to be have a full video on its own, could you briefly go over what her brothers got up to as officers, whether it was common in the late 1700s and early 1800s to bring your wife to sea as a captain or flag officer, and were average civilians able to just walk into a royal dockyard and inspect the ships on the stocks? Okay, so very, very quickly then. Jane Austen had two brothers, Francis and Charles, both of which would achieve flag rank. Charles ended up actually dying while in service as an admiral. He was actually on a Burma campaign, but he caught disease, but he still reached a fairly good old age. You can tell it was kind of the middle of the 19th century because he was aged 73 when he died, and A, was still in command of a force, and B, was only a rear admiral. The other brother, Francis, managed to live to the ripe old age of 91, which, given that he was born in the 18th century and died in the latter half of the 19th century, was a fair old achievement. And he had a whole list of pretty impressive commands, including the fact that, as you can see here, he was in charge of the Canopus, which was part of Nelson's squadron as it chased Villeneuve across the Atlantic and back again. The only reason he wasn't at Trafalgar was he was part of a small force that Nelson detached to resupply at Gibraltar, and they were still there when the battle itself was fought. He'd go on to command the 120-gun first-rate HMS Caledonia, which was Britain's first 120-gunner, and he went on to achieve the rank of Admiral of the Fleet, which in modern parlance is equivalent of a five-star position, and it's kind of, you know, like a game completed rank for people who are playing the Royal Navy tree. And both brothers at various times actually served on anti-slavery patrols, although the West Africa Squadron is of course the most famous of the anti-slavery patrols. There was also an East Africa Squadron, and there were also anti-slavery patrols in the Caribbean, and it was in that latter theatre that actually both Francis and Charles served at various points. As far as bringing your wife to sea as a captain or flag officer, it wasn't common, but it also wasn't unheard of. More so in peacetime than in war, although very occasionally you would find a wife of a senior officer aboard even during wartime. Officially, it was heavily discouraged, and generally speaking, obviously you weren't supposed to be bringing non-naval personnel, should we say, aboard, but when it was the captain or an admiral, etc., there was a certain amount of leeway. And as I said, in peacetime, it wouldn't be unheard of for a officer's wife to be travelling aboard, and indeed even wives of lower ranks as well. Although the lower the rank you got, the more and more it was a case of can you sneak them on board more than you can just arbitrarily bring them aboard. Obviously, in wartime, A, the rules tended to be a little bit more rigorously enforced, and B, when there was a very good chance of you being shot at by angry men with large cannon, most officers would decline to bring their wives aboard for those kinds of missions. Although if you were doing a relatively benign mission, especially if perhaps you were going to be put on assignment to a far-flung corner of the world for a particularly long time and, you know, your wife wanted to relocate to be closer to you, then at that point, you might find someone on board, even in wartime, making essentially a short journey, relatively speaking. And as far as walking into Royal Dockyards, not just average civilians randomly showing up, because of course, in wartime, there was a concern of saboteurs coming in and setting fire to things. In peacetime, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, then civilians walking in to have a look at what was going on was more common. Obviously, the security restrictions were somewhat less, but in wartime, they would actually have guards that would challenge, why are you there? The flip side to that is that if you were a relatively well-known and well-respected civilian, so the guards knew who you were, so you're a local gentry, business owner, etc., then even in wartime, a lot of the time, the guards would just say, yep, okay, well, I know you're not going to do anything particularly stupid, apart from maybe get yourself killed, but we don't really care about that, so in you go, have fun. And, of course, a lot of it would depend on exactly who you were and exactly which dockyard you were at. In some dockyards, the security was a bit laxer than others. And as I said again, you know, if you're a local lord or gentry or a business owner who's supplying a lot of stuff to the Navy, you're much more likely to be waved in than if you were just a generic civilian who happened to be wandering along, in which case you get told to get lost. Brian Stevens asks, the Battle of Midway looms large in our minds as a turning point in the Pacific War. I suppose the self-aggrandizing book title Midway, the Battle That Doomed Japan by Fushida aids in this, as does the rather lopsided nature of the victory. However, I've always seen the Guadalcanal campaign as the turning point. In strategy games, I've often had one battle or a series of battles that neither side really was ready for, but now took everything they could to get to win. They often seem, in retrospect, to be the spot that things turned around. In real life, this looks more like Guadalcanal to me. What are your thoughts? I think both represent turning points in the Pacific War. I guess it would depend on what you define as the turning point, because to me, Midway is not the turning point as in this is where Japan stops and where the Allies start pushing back, because of course the Guadalcanal campaign is the Japanese continuing to push forward and everybody stepping in to try and stop that, so clearly their advance hadn't been stopped. I think what Midway does is it becomes the turning point in as much as it's a more of a moral turning point, and as in a morale turning point, perhaps more accurately. Because up until that stage, every Japanese campaign had either gone spectacularly well for them and spectacularly bad for the Allies in the, you know, broad scope of things, or if the Japanese had taken heavier losses than they would have ideally otherwise liked, it still was kind of on their terms. So you had Coral Sea prior to Midway, which is an interesting one because materially speaking, in terms of ships lost and their effect on the overall fleet strength, the US loses Coral Sea because the Japanese lose a small carrier, the Americans lose a big carrier, and both sides have a fleet carrier damaged. However, it is a strategic victory for the Americans because, of course, a whole point of the battle was to stop the Japanese invasion, and the Japanese do turn their invasion force around because of the perceived threat of the American forces. But from an American perspective of things, it was a kind of, not quite a Pyrrhic victory, but it was kind of, we can afford only a few victories like that. You've sent a fleet in, half of it hasn't come back in terms of major capital forces, plus you've lost a valuable fleet oiler. And yes, the Japanese invasion forces turn around, but there's nothing really stopping them from coming back and doing it again. You didn't sink any of the major troop transports, you didn't sink any of their major fleet carriers, etc. So it's a qualified victory. Whereas Midway, yeah, okay, you lose Yorktown, but you've traded Yorktown for four carriers of the Kido Butai, plus a cruiser and a few other bits and pieces. So now you have an unequivocal victory. You can point to and say, look, the Japanese can be stopped. It will cost us, because Yorktown was sunk and the devastated squadrons were devastated, but the Japanese can be stopped and we can do it while inflicting more losses on them than they have inflicted on us. So now you know that the Japanese can be properly defeated, and that's really good for morale. But of course, as I said, it doesn't actually stop the Japanese advances generally. It stops their attack on Midway, but at the same time, they're taking the Aleutians, they're preparing to take the Guadalcanal area and all the islands around that area, they're still making advances all over the place. Whereas the Guadalcanal campaign is the first time you have a full spectrum engagement, if you like. It's air, land, and sea, taking on a major Japanese advance, and over the course of the campaign, turning it around from, we desperately need to stop them, you know, finishing this airfield, otherwise things are going to go very badly, to, we've completely thrown them off of the island, and we can now start pushing back. Militarily, Guadalcanal is, as the whole campaign, is the actual turning point, because that is essentially where the continuous Japanese expansion efforts in the Western Pacific are stopped, turned around, pushed back, and the Japanese don't really make any major advances after that. They're constantly now on the defensive. And from a naval perspective, it is an absolute meat grinder. You know, Hornet goes down, Wasp is lost in the context of that campaign, Saratoga is damaged, Enterprise is beaten to almost to pieces. And, you know, it's not a cheap campaign for the US Navy, and that's just looking at the carriers, let alone cruisers and so forth. But the Japanese Navy takes just as much of a beating in terms of ship losses overall. And while both sides are forced down to almost no operational carriers in the Western Pacific by the time the campaign is over, the fact is that if you're both sides are low, who is going to recover the quickest? And, well, the US has won the ground campaign. It's got naval dominance, even if its upper-end naval equipment has been pushed almost to breaking point. And then the US very rapidly ramps up and comes back again, much faster than Japan can. So from an overall perspective, Guadalcanal is the turning point. But I would say that Midway, in part, is the victory that gave the American forces at least some of the morale boost they needed to think that Guadalcanal was even possible to win. Elite Corsair asks, is there any record of a low-class sailor performing exceptionally well, saving up their prize money and moving up the ranks of society? Similar to a battlefield promotion from enlisted man to officer. Okay, so we have covered low-class sailors, if you like, the working-class sailors, rising through the ranks meritocratically to high rank before. But in this, we're talking more the social and financial aspect of, you know, has someone gone from, say, lower class to middle class or even upper class simply through succeeding very well in their naval career? I suppose one case would be the chap you can see here. This is Peter Warren. Now, admittedly, he wasn't an kind of working class individual completely. So through his mother, he did have connections, but he was the son of an army officer who, and the family was Catholic, but at the time the law said Catholics couldn't serve in the Navy. So he was from a Catholic family, but raised Protestant, so he could. And although he had some family connections, he still had to enlist as a ordinary seaman. He didn't go straight in as a midshipman the way that most would. So he had a little bit of a leg up, but he still had a lot to prove. He managed, through a combination of a little bit of luck and a lot of skill, to go from being an ordinary seaman over to the officer track. He made lieutenant and rose up the ranks, and he eventually finished his career astoundingly rich from prize money and used it to buy massive amounts of land in both Britain and America. And as you can see, you know, he had portraits done of himself. He commanded successfully in major battles and all this kind of thing. Of course, to have that kind of phenomenal wealth was in large part because he managed to rise through the ranks, because the share of any given prize money that you got increased the higher the rank you were, especially once you got to captain or admiral rank, which he did. Another example might be Lawrence Halsted. He was the son of a naval captain, but not a captain who was particularly well off. And indeed, the only reason he got into the Navy was basically because his father said, okay, look, I'll take you to sea on my ship, which from all accounts was as much a money-saving exercise for his mother and younger brothers ashore as anything else. But he managed to rise through the ranks, fought in a number of engagements, claimed a good deal of prize money, and he ended up marrying Admiral Pellew, aka Lord Exmouth's daughter, and bought a massive multi-hundred acre estate to settle in over in Hampshire, So given that he was rubbing shoulders with the full-on aristocracy by the end of his career, he very definitely had moved up several social strata. Matt Sanderson asks, can you please explain how the thinking of Mahan influenced the naval race of ironclads, pre-dreadnoughts, and in general pre-World War One? Well, he didn't influence ironclads so much with his thinking, mostly because his two books were published in 1890 and 1892, which was basically at the absolute very end of the ironclad era, if you count compound armoured vessels. But he very much did influence pre-dreadnoughts and pre-World War One thinking, because, well, that's right at the start of the pre-dreadnought period. So Mahan influenced naval thinking quite considerably, but exactly how depends on which nation you're looking at and what lessons they took from his book, which is a very important qualifier because, well, I say books, plural, because he did write two at that point. And this is one of the major things that is going on, especially with people like the Kaiser. Mahan advocates, based on historical precedent, for a full spectrum of naval operations, but which can essentially be boiled down to the person who commands the sea will win the war, assuming that there is a naval element to this war at all. So, you know, if you're going to have a land war with Russia and you're in Eastern Europe, naval operations probably not going to have a massive impact on how things are going. But if you are talking about Central Western Europe and even certain conflicts with Russia, like the Crimean War, various Ottoman-Russian wars, etc., there's a heavy naval element involved. And if you command the seas, you will win simply because you can starve your enemy of certain supplies, you can starve them of their economy via crushing their trade and establishing a blockade, and meanwhile you get to enjoy the benefits of global trade and access to raw materials and things. So you essentially will have all the money and resources you need to win the war while simultaneously denying a good chunk of those to your opponent. How you achieve this is a major theme of his writings, and he looked at the various previous campaigns, especially in the Age of Sail, and he'd come to the conclusion that the best way of doing this was to have a massive decisive battle, because if you have a massive decisive battle where a good chunk of the enemy fleet shows up, a good chunk of your fleet shows up, you have a big battle, hopefully you win, and once you win, because you've knocked out a good chunk of the enemy fleet, they no longer have the ability to oppose you on the high seas, which means that you can take control of them, and as I said, establish blockades, you get all the money in the trade, everybody's happy. One of the reasons he was so in favour of decisive battles is because it got that bit over quickly, whereas in some Age of Sail campaigns, he could point to the land wars going back and forth and progressing fairly slowly, because the naval war was going back and forth and progressing relatively slowly, and thus with both sides able to essentially fuel their war machines with overseas trade and supplies, it was a very much a knockdown, drag-out fight, whereas once one side or the other had just completely locked the other side in, then assuming that the two were equal, otherwise, the war spiraled very quickly in favour of the one who had sea control, or even if one side theoretically was on something of a disadvantage, you compare the land fighting power of the British Empire versus the land fighting power of Napoleon, for example, but having the ability to cut off Napoleon's trade and have your own trade switch the balance back in favour of the British. And it wasn't just in terms of arming and equipping and supplying your own troops, as Britain had shown. It also meant you could achieve such astounding levels of wealth from trade, you could afford to bankroll other people to fight for you. But there were, I would say, three major ways in which Mahan was interpreted. For people who had essentially developed this method of war, like, say, the British, they looked at it and went, yeah, that's exactly what we were doing before. That's what we'd like to do in the future. Submarines and torpedo boats did mess that up a little bit, but it meant you went from close blockade to distant blockade, but the principle was essentially the same. So Britain essentially just went, yeah, cool, thanks for validating what we were planning on doing anyway. Fantastic. Other nations, not necessarily smaller nations, but one with smaller navies, looked at it and went, okay, so the one thing we have to do is either avoid a decisive battle or at least have a fleet that is large enough that they don't want a decisive battle with us. Because even if we lose, there won't be enough of the enemy fleet left to do the sea control bit. And that was in part what at least funded some schools of thought for the US Navy. Other schools of thought thought the US Navy should just be all dominant, but a certain more conservative number thought that the US Navy should at least grow to the point where the conceivable forces that an opponent might send to the other side of the Atlantic or the other side of the Pacific wouldn't be able to enforce a full blockade after they ground the US Navy down. Weirdly enough, Japan was in a somewhat similar situation because they, although they were much physically closer to some potential opponents, their biggest potential opponent being Russia, had to maintain three separate fleets, two of which were on the other side of the planet. So again, it was a case of not so much we have to build a fleet big enough to face the entire Russian fleet, we have to build a fleet big enough to face the amount of the Russian fleet that can be present in the Western Pacific. So that was more of a looking at Mahan's lessons on how to achieve victory and perhaps thinking about more about how to deny victory to the other side. Although in, say, the Russo-Japanese War, the Japanese were then able to leverage that into a localized way of Mahan's fall theory. And then you got people who got as far as the decisive battle, now you will win bit, and went, oh, so the decisive battle is how we win the war. And they built fleets centered entirely around having a decisive battle under the mistaken apprehension that this would result in them then winning the war, because presumably everyone would see that they'd won this big battle and then go, okay, well, clearly you're a superior life form, therefore we will give up and go home. Completely failing to read the other half of Mahan's doctrine, which is, yes, once you have won the decisive battle, you will win the war by doing the following things. People won't just bow down to you and, you know, go GG and quit. Sapa Ninja asks, this may be a little outside the scope of the channel, but something I find when looking at some historical conflicts is the numbers of people involved and subsequently casualty numbers seem implausible to me. If we take, for example, the Punic Wars, history seems to indicate that in the First Punic War, the Roman Empire lost some 50,000 out of its 300,000 strong male population, presumably heavily weighted into 15 to 45-year-olds. And then a few decades later, it just happened again. It seems to me that such catastrophic casualties would cause a complete demographic collapse. Are the numbers of casualties wrong? Is the census wrong? Is there something I'm missing? Or did the Roman Empire really survive its fighting age male population being decimated twice in three generations? Now, obviously, I'm not a demographic historian, but I do have a sort of a passing interest in ancient Mediterranean, ancient Middle Eastern history to a certain degree. Now, with that said, obviously, if you happen to have done like full-on PhD studies in ancient, let's say, Mediterranean history or some element thereof, and you want to chime in the comments, or you want to point in the direction of perhaps someone who has done a paper or a presentation on it on this kind of subject, then feel free to do so in the comments below. But with that caveat out the way, my personal observations looking into that kind of thing are that there are a lot of problems, I think, with the way that historically, we've estimated ancient populations. There obviously are limitations to how large a human civilization could grow in the ancient past, mostly centered around, you know, the density of food production and how much you could distribute that. However, I think there has also been, certainly from the Victorian period and carrying forward from the Victorian period into the modern period, partly just through inertia and partly through a similar level of bias, this idea that everything that the, let's call them the ancients, Stargate reference, yes, very deliberately intended, could do must be lesser than what, quote unquote, we could do. And when they look back at what we, aka Western European civilization, usually could do in, say, the 16, 17, 1800s, and you're talking about, you know, armies of a few thousands in the late medieval period going up to tens of thousands, and only really seeing armies that would hit a six-digit number with the rise of early industrialization, they kind of went, well, clearly, these ancient, near-primitive people from two millennia ago couldn't possibly have gotten anywhere close to that. So when the ancient account says that there's a 80,000 men fighting 120,000 men and 50,000 of them died, well, the whole thing must be very, very overblown. Now, in some cases, yes, there probably was a certain amount, possibly a very large amount of poetic license as to exactly how large these engagements were. But simultaneously, some of the ancient and properly ancient battlegrounds that we found indicate that there perhaps would be a lot more people involved and over a lot wider, a lot of a wider area than we might otherwise imagine. So, for example, if you'd ask most people in the late 20th century, so how large a battle would you expect to see in, let's say, the what's now the Baltic coast of northeastern Germany 3,500 years ago in the Bronze Age? Most people, if anything, it would have been, small tribes, maybe something that might be a small town. So battles would only be maybe a few dozen to a few hundred per side, and they'd all be from the local area fighting over who gets to fish in this river or whatever. And then we discovered the Talence Valley battlefield, where it became very evident that somewhere around 1300 BC, several thousand people from an exceptionally wide geographic range had met and beat seven kinds of, insert expletive here, out of each other. So not only was this a massively larger engagement covering a much wider geographic, if you like, pull than we'd ever anticipated, but also no record of this battle even taking place had even survived. So if we could so badly underestimate that area of the world, then why also can we not argue that people have badly underestimated the actual capacities of ancient civilizations like Rome, Greece, Carthage, Phoenicia, etc., that we actually have heard about and maybe have done a bit more archaeology about? And sometimes people rely on really old population calculations, which just went, okay, well, this is the footprint of the city, this is the footprint of the buildings, we're going to arbitrarily assign a certain number of people living in each building. And because these are older estimates, again, often holdovers from the Victorian or late 20th or early to mid 20th century, they just assume that this is all buildings must have been one or two story buildings, so maybe at most one large nuclear family per residency, and they kick out a population figure for a city. What we now know, and have known for quite a while, is that essentially skyscrapers, buildings, 70 to 100 feet tall, were being constructed in places like Rome. Now, the bigger ones that were cheaply built were known to collapse, and then there were limitations put in, but the limitations said that you could only build up to, initially 70 to 80 feet, and then later it was reduced is effectively another floor. But when you're looking at large-scale blocks of essentially what are ancient apartment buildings, with possibly up to 10 floors or more between them, suddenly the population density of the city in question could increase very rapidly. So, and that's just Rome, which we know had these buildings. Apply that across the board, and suddenly the population density of the cities could be a lot higher than we have historically thought. So the general population and the size of battles could be a lot higher than has perhaps been traditionally accepted in more recent history. But also you've got the fact that if you're looking at ancient censuses, you've got to count who actually are they counting. Much like Greek democracy was not a vote of everybody, it was a vote of actually a very limited number of people. Even when you're doing a census, is that census actually counting everybody in your population, or is it counting, in the case of Rome, like you ask, is that only counting Roman citizens? Because if it's only counting Roman citizens, it's not counting auxiliaries, it's not counting client states, it's not counting potentially even servants and slaves. So your overall male population might be well in excess of 300,000 if they're just saying, well, there are 300,000 Romans living here. There might be four times that many other non-Roman citizens living in the broader scope of the area. And if you end up with a massive casualty event, then, suddenly you might find a whole bunch of people being told, congratulations, you are now Roman citizens. Servants who have worked faithfully for their masters for a long period of time, people from client states who otherwise wouldn't have been given Roman citizenship now can be, and suddenly your citizen levels have popped back up quite massively. And of course, there is also the simple fact that people would tend to have quite a lot of children, and obviously you've got the whole thing of, you know, average age in that period is, as calculated by the modern standard, is heavily skewed by early infant mortality. But if you've just lost a big chunk of your population to an enemy attack, but your population base, your big cities, farmland, etc., is still broadly there, then that means that, assuming that you had a decent resource base in terms of food and so forth beforehand, that those resources are still there. There's now the resources to feed your larger population, but you're with a smaller population, therefore a much greater number of that smaller population is now going to survive through childhood because food is more plentiful, food is cheaper. And if people are having 4, 5, 6 kids plus, you could actually fairly quickly rebuild your population in the scope of, you know, demographic levels of things. Anyway, those are my thoughts, but as I said, I'm not an expert in those things, but that's what I've observed in my own studies. Feel free to chime in below with your own thoughts. And finally for this week, Seb Dove asks, feel free to use this question to tell us all about something of interest to yourself that you think we may enjoy learning about. Okay, so here's something a little bit off the wall, but is of interest to myself. The ancient debate, or well, ancient in internet terms, of katana versus longsword. Because as some of you may know, I do reenactment, HEMA, etc., etc. And I have fought quite a considerable number of sparring sessions now, both using a katana against a longsword and occasionally using a longsword against a katana. Now, obviously, you do get the extremes on both ends of people like, oh, yes, you know, the katana can cut through steel, it can cut through a tank, it can cut through a European knight's sword. That's nonsense. It's stupid. Equally, there are people who say, oh, well, you know, the katana is basically a slightly sharpened crowbar and the longsword is fine in just European spring steel and the katana will just bend or break against a longsword. And that's mostly also nonsense. And you get the whole arguments about armor and everything. And as many other channels who specialize in that have shown, no, armor does not make you particularly slow or particularly non-agile. It does have limitations. I've fought in armor as well. But it's nowhere near as much as the memes would have you believe. So what is it actually like sparring with a katana versus a longsword? Which would win in an actual sword fight? Well, I would say on balance, a longsword has an advantage. However, it's not spectacularly one-sided. If you are the katana wielder, you can beat a longswordsman, but you do have to work for it. And fundamentally, that comes down to if you have a average-ish length longsword and you have an average length katana, so 2 sun, Japanese measurement, then you can go and look it up, you're going to have a lot more reach with the longsword. Therefore, if you are both starting out fighting from a safe distance, i.e. distance where the other guy can't just stab you without really moving, you as the katana swordsman are going to be considerably further away from getting to a point where you can do damage to your opponent than vice versa. And to cross that distance, you have to pass through the area where your opponent can hit you and you can't hit them. So you are at a disadvantage. Also, mechanically speaking, I found the katana is a slightly slower weapon on a per length basis, mostly because the katana is a weapon which doesn't have a huge amount of change to the blade depth as you go. So you've got the blade width, which will be measured in millimeters, and obviously includes the edge. But the blade depth, i.e. from, well, on a longsword, one cutting edge to the other, from the katana, on the katana from the cutting edge to the back edge, while it does narrow down somewhat, on most katana, that's not a huge proportional narrowing until you get to the area where you get the tip and you get a sharp change and obviously get a point. Whereas with most longswords, the typical longswords, They start out somewhat broad, but they do tend to narrow as proportionally quite considerably as you go. This means that on average, a longsword will be weighted further back. Its centre of gravity, its centre of rotation will be further back, whereas with a katana, that weight is somewhat further forward. Therefore, if you have katana of a similar length to the longsword, the katana will be slightly slower because there's more weight further away from your grip, which means it's going to be harder for you to manoeuvre and get it moving in the first place. And I've actually fought using larger katana, which are about the same length as a longsword, and I consistently lost. I actually win more often if I'm using a katana which is of the standard katana length, the shorter weapon, despite the disadvantage of reach, which I've mentioned earlier, simply because if they are of the same length, generally speaking, the long katana, whatever you want to call it, is a slower weapon than the longsword, and you're just going to get outmaneuvered. But when you have the shorter, more standard length katana, now you have an interesting situation because, yes, technically your balance means it's per length a slightly less wieldy weapon, but it is a considerably shorter weapon, and therefore it is actually still overall lighter. And because you both have a long two-handed grip, you're actually faster with the katana. And because you have a shorter blade, it's also a slightly stiffer blade. Again, the near continuous, not quite, but near continuous depth of the blade also helps with that. And so what that means overall, I found, is that as long as you can get your opponent's point offline, so they can't just stab you, the two-handed grip means that if the opponent cuts at you, you do have a pretty decent chance of parrying or just no-selling the attack, period. And assuming you can get past that point, you can get in slightly closer, the speed of the katana blade and the fact that if you end up in a bind, you will probably then win the bind, means that if you can get close enough to the longsword wielder that you can actually even hit them in the first place, you do have a little bit of an inherent advantage. You actually become more agile as well as faster, closer in, and you can control your opponent's blade more, which then means you can set it aside or knock it aside or whatever you need to do to deliver a cut or thrust, with the big caveat of then you need to get the heck out of there again, because afterblows are a thing. No point in having spent all that time and effort getting in there to deliver a fatal strike if the next thing that happens is as your opponent goes down, he takes you with him. So it is a very, very high energy activity, but it is possible to do. Of course, if you are the longsword wielder, you have the advantage of if the guy's coming at you, you can just poke him with the pointy end as he comes in. If he doesn't get things absolutely correct and offset your point, you can withdraw to keep the range open, which gives you additional opportunities to attack and defend. And you can also do things like half swording and so forth if you are quick enough to re-establish an advantage closer in. Plus, the longer length means greater leverage, which means if you absolutely go ham in a strike, it, even with a two-handed grip, it can be very difficult for a katana wielder to fully parry what you're doing unless they're very skilled. And yes, you do have an advantage with having a cross guard. Depending on the size of the suba on the katana, that it may or may not be quite as bad as you might otherwise think. A large suba is actually quite good at protecting your hands, I've discovered. But essentially, if you are fighting katana versus longsword, the longsword wielder, as I said at the start, will probably win, assuming opponents of equal skill. But if you know everything that I've just described, as a katana wielder, there are ways for you to A, win, and B, if you develop your technique right, potentially win even more often than not. It's just going to take a heck of a lot more energy to do than if you're just wielding a longsword semi-competently. So I hope that was interesting. And with that said, that's time to end this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, and hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.